man. It's game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now?
What are we gonna do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Hello, and welcome to 80s Movie Montage. This is Derek.
And this is Anna.
And this week, we're mostly going to talk about aliens. Mostly.
It's actually a really, really nice way of putting that. Yes, I'm so excited. We love this movie. I feel like I can very confidently include you into the love. Like, we love this movie.
It's one of my favorite movies. It probably is, like, it's up there for favorite sequels with, like, The Empire Strikes Back. But it's such a great sequel in the way that it really honors the original movie. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, to reference a movie we previously covered, turns it up to 11.
It does. No, absolutely. Yeah. And because there is a lot to talk about, let's get started. So, Aliens, 1986. Mm-hmm. So coming in. And so, okay, so just for reference, because it is going to come up, we're going to talk about Alien to some degree, both on our own and with our special guest.
We talk a little bit about the Alien franchise.
Correct. Yeah. And so Alien came out in 79. Mm-hmm. So we just missed our opportunity to really talk about that one. I mean,
we're going to do it anyways.
We're kind of getting around that, yeah, with this one. So this comes out 7 years later. It's an interesting kind of tidbit because, like, even though Alien did incredibly well, it was still an era where it wasn't automatic that if a film did well, that it would have a sequel. So, yeah. And especially, you know, at the time, this was the property of Fox, and it just wasn't really something that they pushed for right away. And, you know, I usually start with the writers, and so this kind of ties into this because unlike other films that we've covered where the writers on it are kind of true writers, like that's their thing, they're screenwriters, that's not actually the case here. So we have a couple different people credited as the writers on this film. Now, a few I'm just going to kind of get out of the way really quickly because Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett. So they have credits because they were the writers on the original movie. And so basically they have like character created by credits. Mm-hmm. They weren't active parts writers on this particular movie.
The story was not from them.
Correct. And we will definitely 100% get to James Cameron in just a second.
Who?
But yeah, exactly. But the two people I want to bring up first are Walter Hill and David Giler, is how I'm going to say his name.
Okay.
So they have writing credits as well. They both have story by credits, mm-hmm. but these aren't people who are like they, if you go to their individual IMDb pages, you'll see actually a fair amount of credits for them. And I'm about to bring up those credits for each of them. But really what they are producers.
Okay.
And they were producers on the original film. These are the two men who really kind of pushed for the sequel to get made and brought Cameron on board. So, and they were executive producers on Aliens. So, a little bit different in terms of when we say writer, definitely had contributions, but and also, you know, we'll kind of go down this path a little bit. Like, Cameron really was the person who created this movie, and he has both a story by and screenplay by credit.
Yeah.
So, it kind of reflects in that. But, in
it
any
feels
case,
like it.
Yeah.
You know, without knowing much about the other two gentlemen,
yeah,
looking at their credits, seeing that they have been involved with the franchise,
yes,
in some capacity,
heavily involved with the franchise as a
but
whole.
The story of Aliens, it just feels like, especially in this era, it feels like a James Cameron type of story.
And Cameron says, you know, they came to me, they gave me kind of a very vague type of synopsis of how they wanted the movie to go. And so it really was up to him. But in any case, okay, so Walter Hill, like I said, story by credit, he produced Alien. He's an executive producer on this movie. Some of his other writing credits are The Getaway, the 1972 Getaway.
Mm.
I bring that up for a reason. We have The Drowning Pool, Hard Times, The Warriors.
Oh, yeah. Come out and play, eh?
There you go.
Yeah.
Southern Comfort, 48 Hours, and Another 48 Hours in terms of the characters from the original film.
Okay.
Red
Heat. He's really capitalized off this. Oh, Red Heat.
Red Heat.
It's a great movie.
Alien 3.
Underrated movie. It's not great. It's not great, but it's like, it's not Godfather 3.
Okay.
You know, it's okay.
I mean, I really just stick to, I mean, we've seen Prometheus, we've seen Covenant, we've seen all those more recent ones. But as far as like the ones preceding, I'm really just an Aliens girl.
Like a lot of James Cameron things, Terminator 2, pretty good. Aliens.
Right, but he wasn't involved with this franchise past Aliens. So you can't blame him for the direction it took.
I'm blaming him for not getting involved.
I mean, there's that argument to be made. I don't know. You know, we briefly touch on that with Michael, our guest, but I could, you know, I guess bother to do some research in terms of like why that collaboration didn't continue.
It makes me already a little concerned for Avatar's 3, 4, and 5.
I think he's much more involved with those. I think so. That's like his baby. So in any case, then for Walter Hill, we have the 1994 Getaway. So he has writing credits on both. And then not the TV show, but the film Last Man Standing. So it's some of his writing credits.
Very different.
Very different. Okay, and so moving on to the other gentleman, David Giler. Another story by credit. Again, produced Alien, was an executive producer on this film. He just recently passed. He passed in December, which, you know, I don't really want to go down this road. But that is something that is a little bit bittersweet about covering movies from the 80s is that, unfortunately, you know, 30 to 40 years on, some people are just no longer with us. It actually is kind of the case with several of the individuals involved in this film. But okay, so some of his writing credits. He did some TV. I thought it was interesting because he has writing credits for both The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
There should be a follow-up, just The People from U.N.C.L.E.
I thought that was just fun.
Yeah.
Movie Maya Breckenridge, The Parallax View. Kind of a similar thing going on.
Wait, what?
Parallax?
I thought that was all one thing.
The Parallax View?
Yeah.
Okay. So kind of similar to Hill. So he has a writing credit for the 1977 version of Fun with Dick and Jane.
Hmm.
And then I'll get back to that in a second. Writing credit on The Money Pit. He kind of reteams with Hill because he also has a writing credit on Alien 3. And then he also has a credit for the the more recent one that had Jim Carrey, The Fun in Dick and Jane.
Okay.
And I believe it was Tia Leone.
I think you're right.
So kind of samesies as like Walter Hill with The Getaway. So, okay. So we've brought him up a couple times at this point. But James Cameron.
Who? Oh, yeah.
So... amazing director, Academy Award winning director, infamous, I should say, for when he won for Titanic saying, you know, I'm on top of the world, Ma, or whatever that line is.
Did he have someone like hold him up in front of the mic when he said it?
You know what's funny is that like, I guess they're, now I'm getting off track, but apparently even though Titanic was this like colossal hit, when he said that line at the Academy Awards, I guess some people did not catch that he was just referencing the movie. And so they thought it was kind of an obnoxious line to throw out when he won. And I just thought that was funny because I was like, well,
it's right from the movie.
Are you one of the three people who didn't see the movie? Like, obviously it's from the movie. But anyway,
it's a lot of movie. Maybe they just missed that part.
It is a long movie. This is true. So most people know him as a director. And actually what I noticed in terms of his writing credits is that he shares a lot of similarities to the gentleman we just covered, Cameron Crowe, and that he really kind of just directs on the stuff that he writes for the most part.
Yeah. Although I think for slightly different reasons. I think for Cameron, it's because he really places an emphasis on like technology and he innovates a lot of the technology. I mean, certainly for Avatar. So whereas I feel like Crow is more about, I have this vision of what my story is and I want to make sure that gets out. And for Cameron, he might be thinking, I don't even know if what I want to get on the film, if the technology exists. So I'll just invent it and make everyone wait 20 years for the Avatar sequel.
So, okay. As far as his writing credits go, it's interesting because, you know, today's topic is the alien, well, aliens, and to some degree the alien franchise. But a lot of people are just as familiar with him, if not maybe more so, because of the Terminator franchise.
Does he have any Terminator credits?
Well, that's just it. So I did a count. So he has currently 54 writing credits. 33 of them relate back in some way, shape, or form to the Terminator franchise, whether that's the movies, video games, whatever, TV shows. So,
yeah.
Okay, so among his writing credits, Piranha 2, The Spawning.
Gross.
That was his first feature credit, and he used a pseudonym. Am I using that word right?
Yeah.
Yeah. H.A. Melton.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know why he didn't want to go by his real name. Maybe because it was Piranha 2. and then we do have the Terminator. Rambo First Blood Part 2. I didn't know that either.
And I talk about this later on about how it is one of my least favorite sequels, just because I think it does such a disservice to kind of the themes that were brought up in First Blood.
Yeah.
Which as a standalone movie is pretty solid.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just goes wild.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks.
I mean, he has a certain style that just carries through with all his films. So
it couldn't have become the franchise that it has become without that kind of treatment.
Because so, he created the platform for what the rest of the franchise would become.
Yeah. So like no one's really upset about it. I just personally feel like the first movie is more of like a legitimate movie that's got more going on, and then the rest of them are just like in a different genre almost.
Yeah. I can see that. All right, then we have The Abyss.
Starring Chris Elliott.
He is in that.
Yeah.
Terminator 2 Judgment Day, another amazing sequel.
I mean, that is, when I think of like a summer blockbuster, it's almost difficult to, like, it's hard to give Terminator 2 all the credit it deserves because it was just insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was one of the biggest summer blockbusters I can remember.
And it's a great movie. Like, it completely holds up.
Yeah.
Completely holds up.
It does.
So, I really love True Lies, notwithstanding the super gratuitous strip scene that Jamie Lee Curtis has to go through.
There's a lot wrong with it, but it is,
But overall, it's a real fun movie.
It is. It was a good time.
We have Strange Days, of course.
Good movie.
Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, some TV. So, we have the TV series Dark Angel. We have, now, I don't know, like, how involved he was, but because they are pulling the characters from Terminator, he has credits, character credits for Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. Of course, you just mentioned it, Avatar. And, you know, all the, let's see, it would be four more movies coming down the pipeline.
Yeah.
So-called.
Yeah.
And then you actually mentioned this with our guest, Alita, Battle Angel.
Yeah, I saw that on the Fox lot when it right before it premiered. It was actually my last day of work at Fox.
Oh, okay.
I went to go see that screening because I didn't really have anything to do other than that and then my exit interview,
right?
And so I saw that there was a moment that was supposed to be kind of like a tragic moment. The theater erupted in laughter.
Not
the reaction that I think was intended,
right?
It had some interesting stuff going on. It was wild. Yeah, I talked about it in my exit interview.
Okay, so writing credits for James Cameron. Now we're moving on to director James Cameron. Same person, but and basically the same credits. So, you know, everything we just mentioned, Piranha 2, Terminator Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, Titanic, Avatar, and then Avatars 2 through 5 that are, none are released yet, but he's kind of like, some are like 2 and 3, I think, are in post, 4 and 5 are filming, I believe. So
there was one for writing that I just wanted to bring up really briefly.
Sure.
Aliens Colonial Marines, which was a game that no one really liked, but it was an aliens themed thing, and he has a credit for characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious as to what characters may have been involved that afforded him that credit when there are other alien like themed games, mm-hmm. like the survival horror Alien Isolation that I don't see on here and I expected to see for his credit. So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, they must have done like kind of some revisionist history because unless maybe Hicks,
it must be tied to
like Hicks or something.
Yeah, it must be tied to the Marines in some way because it is the Colonial Marines.
Yeah, but everybody gets decimated.
Yeah,
except for Hicks. So
it doesn't go well for him in part three, though.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Anyways.
All right. Moving on to cinematography. So I found this. Okay. So here's the thing about this movie. There was we don't really get into it with our guests too much. So there was a lot of conflict on set.
Okay.
Because this film was shot at Pinewood Studios in England. Hmm. And they have kind of a different system where, you know, usually a production itself would hire the crew, but Pinewood Studios has its own crew. And this crew, because they're based in Great Britain, they worked with Ridley Scott when he did Alien. And
so far, so good.
They were very loyal to him. And also between the loyalty to Scott, which, you know, I don't think Scott, to my knowledge, wasn't approached about a sequel. I know he maybe has on record that he felt like a little bad about that. But the two producers that went to Cameron went to him on the strength of Terminator, which hadn't actually premiered overseas. So this crew didn't really know who this guy was.
Okay.
All they really knew is that he had, in their eyes, taken the place of Ridley Scott if there was going to be a sequel. And because of that, there was, a lot of hard feelings between Cameron and the crew. And the reason why I bring that up is because the person who eventually was the cinematographer on this shoot, Adrian Biddle, was not the original cinematographer on the film. The original cinematographer was fired off of the film because he and Cameron just could not see eye to eye.
Well, that's not going to work for Cameron.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
I don't think Cameron wanted to be the bad guy on this film. I don't think he, I think, of course, he wanted there to be harmony.
But he's very much, I mean, from what I've heard, and we always mention all of the different grains of salt that we apply
correct.
To these. So, sure.
Each individual grain.
Yeah. I mean, from what I've heard, my impression is that he's very much, this is how I want to do mm-hmm. it. And if you don't want to do it that way, mm-hmm. then you just don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only person who kind of had his back, I believe, was maybe the production designer on the film. But otherwise, everybody else just kind of treated him as like this upstart who didn't deserve their respect, per se. And then also, there's just a lot of cultural differences because, the way that productions work in the U.S., it's kind of a standard 12-hour day. That wasn't really the way that it worked over there.
Yeah.
The crew members wanted, like, their tea breaks. It was kind of a perfect storm of cultural and other kinds of differences. But in any case, the person who eventually did shot it, Adrian Biddle. So Aliens was his very first DP credit. He, I think, was, like, a camera loader. prior to this. And, he did some great work. And this kicked off an amazing career. And unfortunately, he just passed too soon. He had a heart attack in 2005. Mm. And I think he was just maybe in his 50s. So, but up until then, and now I'm bringing up all this information about him because we very briefly covered him. He was also the DP on The Princess Bride.
Yes. Next year. After Aliens.
Yeah, right? And I did not give him his due diligence in terms of just, I think, really kind of expressing how talented this person was.
Well, I am shocked. I tell you, shocked that someone we may have covered in a prior film is coming up again. So I'm confident that we will have opportunities to redress any of these.
We'll probably be bringing him up again because at some point we're going to do Willow, which was another credit of his.
Definitely.
He got his single Oscar nomination for Best Cinematography on Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
Which actually just celebrated its 30-year anniversary. So that's pretty big deal. Some of his other credits, 1492, Conquest of Paradise. Hmm. City Slickers 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold.
He worked on the not as good but still okay Judge Dredd.
Was just about to bring that one up.
The Stallone
indeed.
One. Yeah.
101 Dalmatians.
That is very topical.
Yes, we're not talking about anything that was like we're talking about, I don't have the year down, but like sometime in the 1990s. I think that had Glenn Close in it. I think that
the,
one did.
The live action. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Fierce Creatures, Event Horizon. Another one of our favorite movies. The 1999 Mummy.
Yeah.
Brendan Fraser.
Not the Tom Cruise one.
Correct.
The good one.
The good one.
Yeah.
So that is fun. Love that he's part of that one. The World Is Not Enough. 102 Dalmatians.
Interesting.
The Mummy Returns.
Okay, but we didn't need the kid.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then his last credit was V for Vendetta.
Which is a good movie. Yeah. It's a solid movie.
Haven't seen it. But I believe you.
Yeah. It's too bad that the mask has turned into like a weird meme.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
You're right about that one. Okay. So that is Mr. Adrian Biddle. Great, great body of work. Okay. Unfortunately, we are moving on to another individual who also passed prematurely. This is somebody who is probably very beloved by anybody who's even just a casual kind of movie lover. We're talking about composer James Horner.
Yeah.
And he passed about 6 years ago in a plane crash. This is somebody that, boy, I had a really hard time trying to call down his list of credits. He had, and now this is just composing. There's like different kind of categories of credits. There's like soundtrack credits, song credit, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. This is his composing credits, 164 over the course of his career, which was, you know, not even close to being finished by the time he passed. He had 10 Oscar nominations. He had 2 wins, and we'll go through all that in a second. He did get his very first Oscar nomination for Aliens, actually.
Oh, for Aliens. Okay.
For this very movie. Yeah. So, okay, some of his credits, bear with me because, again, I think I have 31. There's too many. And I kind of doubled up in some spaces. Okay. So one of his very first credits that I just put in because, you know, I like the fun titles. 1980s, Humanoids from the Deep.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was fun.
I like that title. That's great.
Okay. And now we get into some more familiar films. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
That is, I'm going to say it's still the best Star Trek movie ever made. And the soundtrack for it stands out compared to some of the other movies. I don't know if he worked on others, but the soundtrack in particular for 2, The Wrath of Khan, was amazing.
Well, something that I read is that Cameron unfortunately did not give him a lot of time to turn around this score for Aliens. And he was so short on time that he admitted that he, to some degree, kind of cannibalized some of his existing scores, including that for Star Trek 2. So I don't know if you noticed. I'm not familiar really with the Star Trek movies, so I don't know if you noticed any similarities between
any of them. I did, but I might, you know, if I ever happen to watch Aliens again, I might listen for that.
He's just probably it was just that good that maybe he thought he had cannibalized, but to anybody else, it's like, no, they're very, very different. He did 48 Hours as well as another 48 Hours.
Has anyone ever worked on 48 Hours?
That did not work. I don't know. We'll see. Because I think it comes up again at some point. He came back for Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
Also a solid movie. Yeah.
Heaven Help Us, Cocoon, and Cocoon the Return. Volunteers, The Journey of Natty Gann. Commando, The Name of the Rose. An American Tale, for which he got an Oscar nom for Best Original Song.
Okay.
He came back for An American Tale, Five-O Goes West.
Mm.
Project X, Batteries Not Included, Willow, The Land Before Time, Feel the Dreams, for which he got another nom for Best Score.
Diverse?
No, deservedly so.
Diversedly so.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Oh, this one. This is the, like, same thing as Last of the Mohicans. Sometimes a score on its own just will make me weep. And that's what happened in Glory.
Oh, yeah. You do love that.
The score for Glory makes me bawl. Patriot Games, Sneakers. I love this movie. A Far Off Place with Reese Witherspoon. So underrated. Clear and Present Danger, another really gorgeous score. Legends of the Fall. He gets another, I think he got nominated twice in 1 year because he got nominated for both Braveheart and Apollo 13. I think those were the same year. Hmm. Got Oscar noms for best score on both of them. Then he finally wins. And as you could probably guess, he wins for...
I don't know.
Titanic.
Oh, that makes sense.
He wins two Oscars that year. He wins the Oscar for the best score, and he was the writer of the song, My Heart Will Go On. So, or one of the writers. So he got the Oscar win for best original song as well.
He has done so many good things. I'm not even going to hold it against him that he's song. Responsible for that song.
That's an earworm song for
I
sure.
I can let it go.
And as you can see, because he gets another nom for best score for A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
He gets one for House of Sand and Fog. And then his last Oscar nom for best score was for Avatar. But as you can see through just the selection of credits that I've brought up, not only did he have a very close relationship with Cameron, which actually had to go through kind of a stage of repair because he, you know, wasn't too keen on what Cameron made him do on Aliens because he wasn't really given enough time.
Yeah.
But they came back together, obviously, and collaborated again. But he also, you know, very clearly had a close relationship with Ron Howard because, you know, he did the score for several of his films as well.
He's scored so many films, it's almost impossible to go through.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just so many.
And then just a couple of his very last, The Amazing Spider-Man, and then his very last credit was for The Magnificent Seven.
Hmm. The remake with everyone.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say with a lot of people.
With Star-Lord. With,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on to film editing. A gentleman that we have brought up a couple times, actually. Ray Lovejoy. So, and this was another gentleman that, you know, one of his very first credits was for a film you might have heard of called 2001 A Space Odyssey. And because Aliens was another...
I've heard of it. Yes.
Because Aliens was another, like, space movie, I think he, from what I read, kind of was using the same type of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, cadence, you know, in terms of editing.
Okay.
And kind of, so it was very slow-paced initially. So much so that Cameron, because that's the way that, like, Kubrick kind of, you know, like, that was all coming from Kubrick. And his,
I mean,
his,
yeah. What is, like, the first 10 minutes or the damn slow-mo...
Exactly.
...of like, the shuttle docking with a space station for 2001.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was kind of going off of that experience, and Cameron was like, no, like, that's not what this film is.
The tagline is literally, this time it's war. We're going to have to speed it up.
Yeah, so they kind of, I'm not going to say necessarily butted heads, but Cameron was just like, I don't know if this guy's going to, like, put together what I am envisioning. And so ultimately he pulled through and he, you know, they came to an agreement. So it all worked out. But that was something that was initially a little bit of an issue. Okay, so one of his credits that I had to just include, again, love the title, Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs.
I hope it worked out for Little Malcolm. That sounds like
a
problem.
I mean, that is a whole story in a title.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I don't know if you're going to bring it up, but I wanted to bring up 1983's Krull. A movie that is such a bizarre, weird fever dream of a fantasy that kind of, like, I feel like it kind of robs some elements from Star Wars, that type of mythology. It's just a weird movie.
Krull. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And there's no reason that you would have, like, keyed in on it to pick that out, but it's just weird. It's really weird. There's, like, this, instead of a lightsaber, there's, like, some cool thing that he, like, throws around and, yeah.
Okay.
It's bizarre.
All right.
But there was also like a Krull Marvel adaptation thing in the other credits that Horner had scored or worked on the music for. So I had to bring it up. When I saw it come up again for the editing, I'm like, okay, there's too much Krull here for me to not bring it up.
Thank you for doing your due diligence.
That's what I do.
Okay, so we've talked about him because he cut both The Shining and Batman.
Yeah.
So, and we brought those both up last year. We're back to A Far Off Place. He cut A Far Off Place, which I love. Inventing the Abbots, Lost in Space. And then his last credit was for a film called Vacuums.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Space. Also space related, kind of, maybe.
Probably, maybe. Okay, finally. Not to say that it wasn't totally worth going through everybody who is like behind the scenes on this. But now we are getting to this literal star-studded cast.
Also, Vacuums is just about vacuum cleaning businesses.
Is it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, wow. Okay. So well, we were wrong. All right. This movie, this franchise is Ellen Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver, until we get to these later movies like Covenant and Prometheus. But anyway, we're going to forget that for now. Oh, boy. Sigourney, I love this actress. I really love her. I hope she gets her due someday and gets that Oscar. She has been nominated 3 times, and the first nomination was for Aliens.
Interesting.
Yeah. And at least the way that they put it, she was like the first woman nominated for an action film, which I'm not disagreeing with that. But, you know.
Was there much buzz after Alien? Was there any attention or no? Because just of
That's a really great question.
I think it was still perceived as just like a horror, like a space horror movie. Yeah. So it was probably just you couldn't ignore it after Aliens.
Yeah, that's actually, though, a very good question. I'm very curious about what the buzz was around. I mean, in part, it launched her career, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and we do talk about this with Michael about how once she came back for the sequel, she was really the only like huge star that was part of it. Many of the people in the movie have also come on to, or
they
gone
become,
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But okay, here we go with some of her credits. Her very first film credit was for Annie Hall, and I put down her description. So she was Alvy's date outside theater.
Okay.
That was her, quote, name in that credit. All right. So Alien was actually just her third film credit. So she was a very young actress by the time she did that movie. And then, of course, she came back for both Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection.
You know, one thing I've noticed about Alien 3 is that everywhere it's listed, it looks like Alien Cubed.
Well, yeah, that's why it's like such a, I mean, it's a stylistic choice, whatever.
Yeah.
But
stupid,
yeah.
Stupid superscript.
Alien Cubed. The Year of Living Dangerously, she then, I mean, preceding Aliens, has a huge hit with Ghostbusters and comes back. So we have talked about her. We talked about her in Ghostbusters,
oh,
but
yeah.
That was a year ago.
Yeah.
So she comes back for Ghostbusters 2, and then she has a brief cameo in the 2016 Ghostbusters. So we have her there. She gets her second Oscar nomination. And actually, samesies is like with Horner getting nominated in the same year. She had a very good, I want to say it's 1988, because she got nominated twice. She got nominated for Best Actress for Gorillas in the Mist, which is a great movie.
Yes.
And then she also gets nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Working Girl.
Okay.
So she does have all of her noms in the 80s. She hasn't been nominated since, which I think is a travesty in some ways.
Yeah.
So she was in 1492, Conquest of Paradise. She's in Dave. Great movie.
It is.
That's
yes.
a really good
Kevin
movie.
Kline?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Death and the Maiden. Copycat. Another great movie. The Ice Storm. I thought she would have maybe gotten nominated for that. Maybe like Best Supporting, but oh, love this movie. And we were just talking about watching it again, Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, she's great.
She's so good. This movie I've brought up several times just by happenstance that I do love it. Heartbreakers.
She does have quite a bit of range in all
she
these
does.
Roles.
She does.
Really?
She's a great actress.
Yeah.
The Village.
Yeah.
And she, you know, reteams with Cameron because she's in Avatar. And from what I see on IMDb, she's going to be in all the others coming out as well. Love her cameo in Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
Such a great cameo. Perfect for her. I listed this literally just for you.
Oh, I know it's going to be.
Because I don't list video games, really. but I know that you were a big fan of Alien Isolation. And she actually does the voice work for the character of Ellen Ripley. They got her to come back.
If you enjoy video games and you enjoy kind of like the horror type and you're a fan of the Alien franchise, it's like one of the best. They did one of the best jobs I've ever seen as far as like really capturing the look and feel and music. And you're just being hunted by an alien. It's terrifying.
So there you go.
Yeah.
And then outside of these Avatar movies that are soon to be coming out, we are also waiting on Ghostbusters Afterlife, which she is in. So reprising her role.
It's as
Dana Barrett.
She was, I thought she had a good character in The Defenders as well on Netflix, the Marvel Defenders show.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought she was good in that.
Cool. So second, cool. billing in this movie goes to Ms. Carrie Henn, who plays Newt. Rebecca, really, is her name, but Newt. And what an interesting career, because pretty much this is one and done for her. She had this amazing role in this blockbuster movie, and then was like, yeah, I'm good. And I believe she went on to become a teacher. She has one other acting credit, which is literally just from last year, for a film called Thunder Island, in which she plays a union worker. So I'm guessing it's not a huge role if she doesn't actually have a name.
Union worker.
But I just, you know, that happens from time to time.
And it looked like that was a voice for an animated project.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. So yeah, this is pretty much it. And you know what? Good on her for being like, yeah, it was fun, but this is not the way I want like my career path to go.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's legit.
Mostly teach. Yeah.
Okay. So moving on to Corporal. Do you know what Hicks' first name is?
Yeah, it's Corporal.
His first name is Dwayne.
Dwayne Hicks?
Yeah.
Okay.
He doesn't strike me as Dwayne, but okay. Because what's interesting about that is even though pretty much none of the Marines are ever called by their first name, I don't think they ever are, they just basically have the first name of the actor playing them. He's kind of the only one that doesn't, which I thought was funny. And, you know, we do talk about with our guest that he was, you know, this role was recast with him. So even the original actor does not have the name Dwayne. So I just thought that was kind of funny. In any case.
We're changing. Let's make it Dwayne now.
Yeah.
All right.
So Michael Biehn, has had a great career. I thought this was interesting. And I'm like, okay, we're going to have to scour this movie to find him. So he has an uncredited credit, like literally one of his very first credits. Uncredited credit is Mike, a school athlete in Greece.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
We like just had that on yesterday. So we're going to have to find him.
Yeah, that's...
Isn't that wild?
That is crazy.
So he kind of starts off in television. He was in a TV series called The Runaways. And then he leaps to fame with Terminator, Kyle Reese. Mm. So from there, you know, some of his other credits, we have Rampage, The Seventh Sign. He comes back to reteam with Cameron for The Abyss. K2, Johnny Ringo.
He's amazing in that.
Tombstone. Yeah. Jade, The Rock, Dead Men Can't Dance. I put that in because
you like that title.
Titles.
Yeah.
He comes back for the TV series The Magnificent Seven. He is in the film Clock Stoppers, another TV series, Adventure Inc. He's in the film Grindhouse. And then more recently, again, more television. So TV series 24 Hour Rental. And then we probably most recently saw him in The Mandalorian.
Yes. We were like, is that
just one episode?
Him? Yeah.
Just one episode. Yeah. But okay. So now we have Burke. So Mr. Paul Reiser, again, does an awesome job of being a very despicable character in this movie.
He's so awful.
You know, at least the aliens don't fuck each other over for a percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's awesome. And again, a gentleman who's had an amazing career. So his first credit was the movie Diner.
Oh.
Yeah. And then he was in Beverly Hills Cop and Beverly Hills Cop 2. Do you remember the TV series My Two Dads?
I do.
Yeah. So yeah. I remember him from that.
I mean, you might think from the title that it was a very progressive.
Right.
And it was not.
It was not.
No.
I think it was just more than anything. I think they were like, okay, how do we capitalize on this three men and a baby thing that happened a couple years prior? And then that's what they came up with.
That title is like not really representative.
No, it's not at all. One Night at McCool's, Funny People. Then I didn't realize he had his own show, The Paul Reiser Show.
It's a good title.
Very clear about what it is. He was in the film Whiplash, The Little Hours. And now, more recently, he's done a ton of television. So we watched a couple episodes of this, Red Oaks. Remember that?
Yeah, also Married.
Also
He was on Married.
Oh, okay. I didn't put that one down.
Yeah.
Red Oaks. He was in Stranger Things. Could you remind me? Because, like, obviously we've watched that, and I don't remember who he is in it.
Yeah, no. He's definitely was, like, a scientist of sorts, I believe.
Okay, okay.
And, like, I'm trying to remember.
Terrible that I'm like, oh, I don't clock him.
I feel like he had his Burke redemption a little bit, like.
I think you're right. Yeah. Okay, now it's coming back to me.
The Burke redemption
tour. Because it's just been a while. Like, man, when is that season 4 coming out, man?
Yeah, I think
are
he's
they waiting
like,
again until Halloween?
Hey, I kind of fucked these people over in Aliens. So if I could save a couple people with these like other not aliens, and they're like, we'll help you out.
Sure. I mean, not the same character, but I feel you.
It's very different, but very that's different. Just how I instinctively feel that's how it all went down.
Now, he had his big heyday in the 90s with the TV series Mad About You with Helen Hunt. And then they, like, rebooted it for, like, a hot second. So,
yeah, about 174 episodes. So I feel like he can kind of do whatever he wants.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
He's fine.
And then most recently, he's been on The Kominsky Method. So yeah. A lot of TV work for him.
He was also, he played the role of Gary in Horse Girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't have any other details.
Cool.
Horse Girl.
Now, moving on to another gentleman who I didn't realize. I mean, obviously, I know he's a great actor. I did not realize that Lance Henriksen has currently 259 acting credits.
He owes a lot of those to Aliens.
Sure.
In a way.
Sure.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But so he plays Bishop. What does he like to call himself? Artificial human?
He prefers artificial human.
Artificial person? Artificial human?
Probably person.
Artificial person. Yeah. So what a career, indeed. One of his earliest credits, Dog Day Afternoon. Did you know that he's also, can you remind me, who is he in Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
I cannot tell you that.
He must be one of the, like, government guys.
Probably. That's kind of like his look.
That's another one that we're going to have to be like, okay, like, we got to find him. In this.
Yeah.
He is in Damien Omen 2, The Visitor. He's in Piranha 2. So that might be, I'm guessing, where his relationship with Cameron started.
That's interesting.
The Right Stuff. I do remember him, his little cameo in Terminator. So he's part of the police force.
Yeah.
Jagged Edge. I'm mentioning Near Dark because that movie is going to come up two more times over the course of this conversation. So he's in Near Dark. We just watched him last year in Pumpkinhead.
Man, that movie kind of sucked.
Why did he not just bring his kid to a hospital?
Yeah.
Why would you not even try bringing your kid to a hospital?
I mean, that was a good horror movie if you just like a bad horror movie with... But the effects like had some connection with Alien, right? Like the monster design.
Stan Winston, I believe, directed that film. And Stan Winston was the special effects guy.
It felt sometimes like they knew that they had an interesting enough concept, but they're like, no, we're making it bad and you're not going
to
stop us.
There are ways to fix that story.
Yeah.
To make it better. I just like could not get past the fact that he would not even bring his kid to a hospital. That really just kind of full stop killed my momentum or like my wanting to keep watching. Anyway,
moving on.
So he does have an appearance in Alien 3.
He has a pretty important appearance in Alien 3.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's all I'll say. Okay. I don't want to spoil Alien 3 for people who haven't watched it. It's only been out since 92.
The Quick and the Dead, Powder, the TV series Millennium. This is another one. So, okay, we just watched this. Oh, no. I now remember who he is. He's that old school director in Scream 3.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. He plays Charles Bishop Weiland in Alien vs. Predator, another movie we just rewatched. He is in... Now, I thought this was funny because we did this, I think, in our last episode. So he's in a movie called The Da Vinci Treasure that came out in 2006, not to be confused with The Da Vinci Code, which also came out in 2006.
I'm sorry. Did you just say that both of these came out, The Code and The Treasure came out in the same year?
Correct.
And I've only heard of The Code.
Right.
So how did The Treasure do?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it's like when we were talking about The Last Picture Show and The Last Movie that both came out in 71.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's confusing. I just thought that was fun. So I bring this up because he's continued with the Pumpkinhead franchise. So there are a couple TV movies, Pumpkinhead Ashes to Ashes and Pumpkinhead Blood Feud. And he was in those. And then obviously had to have this title. He was in a movie called Bring Me the Head of Lance Hendrickson.
Oh.
So.
That's amazing.
There you go. I mean, that's quite an honor, right? To have a movie named after you?
It is. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he was in the TV series Tron Uprising.
Oh, nice.
Okay, moving on.
So were you going to... The only thing I wanted to bring up was it's amazing. He has such a remarkable career, and he had told himself prior to being in Aliens, look, if this whole acting thing doesn't pan out right now, I'm done. Mm-hmm. And he's Bishop in Aliens, and then he's everywhere and even has a movie with his name in the title.
The rest is history.
It worked out.
Worked out.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to Mr. Bill Paxton, who is Private Hudson.
Mm-hmm. Game over. That is his line, his best line from this movie.
Correct. We bring that up. Yeah. So another gentleman who just left us too soon. He passed. That was a hard one. That was a hard one when he passed away.
Yeah. I mean, it was very unexpected.
Yeah. He had had a major surgery, so I don't know what the risks involved were.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always risk with surgery, but he had a pretty substantial heart surgery procedure and then basically had a stroke following that surgery. And so he essentially died from surgery complications in 2017. So he is very missed. Had just an amazing career. This is another movie where we're going to have to spot him. So he plays, quote, soldier. That's his role title in Stripes.
Interesting.
So we have a couple movies that we have to get through to find these actors and their like first appearances.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. That's crazy.
So, Paul, I'm going to say that a lot of people do know that he's in Terminator. He has a very bit role. He is listed as punk leader, but he is memorable.
Yeah, it's the opening scene. Is it at Griffith Observatory?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, as punks do, they just like to hang out at a, you know, observatory and look down on the city of Los Angeles. And they pick a fight with a naked Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is not a good idea, even if he wasn't a Terminator.
I would agree with you. Yeah. Okay, so moving on. He is amazing in Weird Science, Chet.
He's such a dick in that.
So good. He is so good. He has just this uncanny way of like when he kind of became like a little bit more of a leading man towards the end of his career and would get like lead roles, but he was a great character actor, you know, where he would just steal every scene he was in, and Weird Science was definitely one of them. So he was in Commando. He also was in Near Dark with Lance Hendrickson.
We might have to cover Commando, it sounds like,
or Near Dark,
or both.
Predator 2. We know him also from Tombstone.
Oh, yeah.
So he kind of reteams with Michael Biehn.
I mean, they're kind of on opposite.
Yes, they're not on the same side, but they reteam for the movie. He's also in True Lies.
Yep.
Has a great turnout in Apollo 13. Here's what I was talking about. So he has like the lead role in Twister alongside Helen Hunt. So great movie, fun movie. He also has a role in Titanic. A Simple Plan. You like that movie, don't you?
I am not as familiar with A Simple Plan.
Oh, I wonder who that was. But
who was it?
I don't know. Who told me that they really like A Simple Plan? He's in Mighty Joe Young, U571. So he has a like great role that, you know, went on for several seasons in the TV show Big Love.
Yes.
So that was like a huge, huge role for him. And then he also was in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Nightcrawler, and then I believe, you know, prior to his passing, one of his very last credits was the TV series Training Day.
So two more credits I want to give a shout out for. Frailty, which is kind of
maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Frailty, I think, is a kind of underrated horror movie where you're not sure if it's a just straight up horror movie or if there's some supernatural thing. But it's a good flick.
That's probably what I was thinking of,
and then,
instead of A Simple Plan.
He also was credited as quote unquote man in the Limp Bizkit video Eat You Alive.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry for overlooking that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to Lieutenant Gorman.
This fucking guy.
Who was played by William Hope. He's had a really interesting career. So, you know, nothing to sneeze at. He has 176 acting credits.
I mean, yeah.
So he's been doing
it's pretty good.
Pretty great. And then, I mean, here's the thing. It does not mean anything. A lot of what I was coming across were credits where I just wasn't familiar with the project. I tried to list ones that I was like, oh, yeah, that's recognizable. So some of his credits, Hellbound, Hellraiser 2, The Saint, Triple X, or however you say that. Little X, Big X, Little X.
Triple X.
There you go. the 2003 Labyrinth.
Oh.
Sky, Captain, and the World of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, and isn't it also, oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name. He's in Captain Marvel.
Samuel Jackson?
No, British guy.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Oh my gosh.
We're going to have to edit this out
now.
You're
going to have to find him because, and I my apologies.
Jude Law.
Thank you. Yeah. My apologies to Jude Law. Okay. He's in the film Sherlock Holmes, TV series MI5, the film Dark Shadows. Now, here's what was interesting. Well, let me just wrap up. So another one of the TV series he was in was called Deep State. But what I noticed is that he somehow hooked up with this Thomas and Friends series.
All over Thomas and Friends.
All over Thomas. So tons of voice work. And I finally just did the math on it. So in little more than 10 years, because I think like maybe his first credit for Thomas and Friends was like around 2009. Hmm. So about 10 years worth of work, but he has 56 credits.
You know what I like about these credits is that most of them are Thomas and Friends with an ampersand. Some of them, however, they spell out and.
Oh, that drives me off the wall.
It's a little odd.
You got to be consistent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so he really, you know, he is all in that Thomas and Friends world.
Yep.
Okay, moving on. We got two more people. So we could not possibly talk about Aliens without talking about Jeanette Goldstein, who plays Private Vasquez. Aliens was her first credit. Now, here's the thing. We have brought up before that often 80s movies have some problematic elements to them.
Yes.
And
some of them are more overt and in your face, like what we saw in Trading Places. I don't think this is the same as that.
No.
Not quite.
I mean, here's the thing. Jeanette Goldstein, Private Vasquez, is a person of Latinx heritage to some degree.
Yeah.
Jeanette Goldstein is not a person who is of Latinx heritage.
Yeah.
And they did make her up in a way, including coloring of the skin.
Yeah.
To make her look that way.
Yeah.
So something that I would very much hope would not be the case today in terms of casting.
They short-circuited her.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
And that being said, though, I want to absolutely give credit to the amazing performance she does. She knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
She does a great job.
Yeah.
So you can, I believe, have both things going on simultaneously, where that's a problematic element, where somebody of a certain heritage was not hired and then made up to look of that heritage.
I can say, I don't feel bad at all saying it shouldn't have been done that way.
Right.
But she did an amazing job.
She did an amazing job.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know how to reconcile those two things, but that's the reality of it.
Right. So some of her other credits... This is what I was talking about. She also is in Near Dark. So her, Bill Paxton, Lance Hendrickson, all in Near Dark. Now, I knew that, but I wasn't really thinking about it until I was, like, doing the research on this. And here's where, like, the kind of interesting connection comes in. So Near Dark was written by and directed by director, well, writer-director, Kathryn Bigelow.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. So one of only two women who went on to actually win Best Director at the Oscars. So that's her, same person. And she also just happens to be one of the exes of James Cameron. So I don't know what that connection is. Now, from what I know, he was, you know, we bring up Gail Ann Hurd, who is another one of his ex-wives, who was the producer on Aliens. And so I don't believe that he and Bigelow were connected at that point in time when Aliens was being filmed. But I mean, the coincidence is just kind of bizarre that all three people in this movie also went on to be in her movie. And then her and Cameron were married at one point, very briefly. But in any case, just put in that.
These people spend a lot of time together.
They spend a lot of time together. Okay. So some of her other credits, Lethal Weapon 2. She has a very pivotal, small but pivotal role in Terminator 2. She is John Connor's foster mom.
Oh, yeah. No, she's the one who is caught in the lie about Wolfie.
Yes.
How's Wolfie? Guess what? There's no Wolfie.
There's no Wolfie. She is in Star Trek Generations, Fair Game. I don't know if you – do you remember her? Same thing. I mean, she has – boy, does she pack an emotional impact in this movie. Do you remember her in Titanic?
I do not.
So she plays the Irish mother who is essentially trapped with her children and is telling them kind of this fairy tale as she is well aware that they are all about to die.
Yeah.
Heart-wrenching moment. And she, again, just does an amazing job.
I don't know if her scenes in The Presidio were as heart-wrenching, but that's a good crime action Sean Connery, Mark Harmon movie.
Okay.
From the 80s, in fact, yeah, that she was in.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Living Out Loud, and she is also in Clockstoppers with Michael Biehn.
Hmm.
So some reteaming there.
A lot of clock stopping.
Yeah. Okay, lastly, but not least, we have Elle Matthews, who plays Sergeant, am I saying that right?
Sergeant Apone.
Sergeant, thank you. Yeah, I was saying that wrong. Apone. He recently passed as well. I guess we're talking about the 1980s. He passed in 2018 and did not have like a huge career, but obviously, you know, this role in particular is so memorable. But some of his other credits, we have Ragtime, Superman 3, which I know you brought up.
Yeah.
You recognize
him. I don't think I made the connection, but watch Aliens all the time, and then randomly Superman 3 was on, and I realized that he's like a firefighter, fire chief
in
that movie. I'm like, oh my god, it's that guy.
The American Way, just adding to our list of films that we need to watch to find these performances. He's in The Fifth Element somewhere. Mm-hmm. and then Tomorrow Never Dies. So nice. Some of his credits. Okay, we are through.
I hope everyone enjoys our new 5-hour format.
So, okay, I gotta bring this up because I'm well, let me just read it off to you, okay? Film synopsis. 57 years after surviving an apocalyptic attack aboard her space vessel by merciless space creatures, Officer Ripley awakens from hypersleep and tries to warn anyone who will listen about the Predators.
That's a really bad synopsis.
It's awful. It doesn't bring up the Marines. It doesn't bring up them going back to LV-426. Like, it doesn't bring up basically the story.
The actual story is not reflected in this.
I mean, again, like, you know, really what this is like a log line for a film. They call it a film synopsis. It's really a log line.
Yeah.
Log lines are hard to write because you are trying to encapsulate what a film is in usually a single sentence. But that being said, this is bad. It's not good. If you really didn't know what Aliens was about, this does not do justice to the movie.
I mean, the moon that they're turning into the shake and bake colony, as they say,
right,
is the same moon in the original Alien, right? That was where the beacon was. Because even in the storyline, they talk about this time the aliens have taken over a space colony on the moon LV-426. But it's the same moon, unless I'm confused.
No, it's the same.
But they're, yeah.
So
anyways.
In any case,
neither the logline, plot synopsis, or storyline necessarily do a great job.
No.
We're happy to write a new one for them.
Exactly. And, you know, this podcast is called 80s Movie Montage. It's really not. Not a montage. I mean,
it's the only thing that would make this movie perfect if there was like an 80s music montage with the aliens kind of dancing. And
you can make a little bit of an argument that when they are readying to drop down to LV-426, because basically what's happening is just like condensed time, because they're showing them, you know, getting everything together. So yeah kind of. And then you have like that military music that's like backing it up. So, you know, so kind of.
Okay.
But that's about the best we can do
right.
for this one. So, all right. We have gone through a lot and we have a lot more to talk about with our awesome guest, Michael. So let's hit it.
Let's do it.
And so Derek and I are beyond thrilled to have with us today Michael Fair, who is the founder of the Film Festival Circuit, which manages 10 different film festival events across Texas, Oregon, and Nevada. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you. This is a great opportunity. It's good to be on here with you.
We're so excited. I mean, we're excited, first of all, to have you on the show. And then also, we're so stoked because we adore this movie. And so we were really thrilled when you mentioned it, that would be one that you'd want to talk about. So we're going to dive in because I feel like there's like a lot to cover. So, Michael, this is my usual first question that I throw out there.
Sure.
Do you have a specific memory or an experience that you recall of your very first time watching this movie, and what was it?
Well, that's a good question. So just to rewind, I mean, I'm a child of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And this movie was right in those impressionable ages. I was born in 1974, so you can imagine the mid-80s when this comes out. I forgot when Aliens came out, but I was 10 or 11 years old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first memory is I think I saw it. So my father was in the army, so we lived in Europe. And I lived in Germany as a kid on a military base. And I wasn't old enough to go and watch Aliens. And I went to stand in line and I got turned away, actually, at a little base theater to watch the film. And I had to wait for it to come out on VHS and bootleg and all that kind of stuff. And so a couple of my friends finally got to watch it. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, you're not supposed to be doing it. You know, your parents are like, don't want you to watch a rated R movie. But yeah, my first memory is getting turned away at the theater because I didn't have a parent with me.
That's amazing. I mean... Because we talk occasionally about how common it was for, you know, movies of this generation. Like, I remember seeing The Exorcist with my parents, you know, and I vividly remember seeing Aliens in the theater because I was born a year after you and my dad loved Aliens. So we went to go see Aliens, and there's that moment at the end when Ripley, spoiler for people who haven't seen Aliens yet, kind of saves the day and tells the Queen Alien what's what. And the reaction of the theater is like one of those theatrical experience memories that I have that just makes going to the movies really special because it's still so vivid in my memory. So I am so sorry that you were...
Initially,
you must have found the one theater that enforced those guidelines.
Well, the thing that is interesting to me about what you said is that I don't know what kind of idea I have about movie theaters in Europe, but I usually think of it as being more sophisticated. So I'm like, why wouldn't you let a kid into seeing it? I mean,
well,
go ahead.
For those who don't know, so when you live on an army base and your dad is in the army, the way the army bases and the Air Force bases are set up is they're like basically these little sprout up communities, these little American, you know, 10-mile circles in the middle of Germany and things like that. And you have the base theater, which is run by Americans. And it also just so happened that my father was the chief of police of the whole base. And so he would definitely enforce this whole rule about kids not getting in. And you know, my parents weren't into science fiction at all. So there's just no way they were going to take me. So, you know, it was just one of those things you get turned away at the theater every once in a while. You kind of try to pretend, you try to find somebody else who might look like your dad or whatever, and kind of like hang close, you know, maybe kind of fake, like put your arm sort of around them where you're not touching and try to slip in.
Hover hand.
Maybe did that before.
Yeah, we did that. You know, I did that, you know, and you tap on somebody's shoulder and you're like, hey, you know, like, you got change for $1, you know, right when you're going in. And I don't even think I was ever successful, but I was, you know, I was a pretty slick kid. So I just wouldn't take no for an answer kind of thing. So
I'm curious, the fact that you were in Europe and, you know, mm-hmm. you're a kid, this movie's coming out. I know that it had, obviously, you know, there was great interest because of Alien. But mm-hmm. for you as a kid in Europe, like what if you can recall, was there a lot of like demand? Were people really excited about this movie coming out, or was it just you as like a young movie lover wanting to see this?
No, this was a major blockbuster. Mm-hmm. This is a major blockbuster film. And when there's a blockbuster film, people would line up. And so
okay.
the gigantic crowds that would, you know, Alien and Terminator, especially Terminator 2. I don't think you could get into the base theater for Terminator 2 for like 2 weeks. Like just everybody and their mother was lined up for that thing.
Wow.
And these are the James Cameron days. This was like his, you know, the James Cameron spin on anything. And then, you know, my dad, of course, who's in the army, is looking at their guns and looking at what they're doing. And he's just like, what kind of crap is this? You know? But for a kid, you know, you just want to see some stuff blow up and, you know, they're getting the acid, you know, sprayed on them and stuff like that when they're shooting. And you're just like, as a kid, you're just into it, you know, and just dark science fiction like this mm-hmm. has just always been my thing. And to this day, it's still my favorite genre.
Oh, very cool. That's awesome that we get to then talk about this particular film with you.
This is a great match.
Yeah, a great match. Sure. And so, okay, so you're initially turned away. You don't get to see it as soon as you want to. But when you do, I mean, you're saying that this is your favorite genre. Obviously, like you said, huge blockbuster film. So was it a positive first experience? Was it everything that you thought it would be?
Yeah, I thought it was. I loved it. I mean, I think we got a VHS copy of it like, you know, a year after it came out. And me and a couple of my friends, you know, I had that one friend whose parents just don't care. You know, so you can go over there and do anything you want.
Those are the best.
You know, the 13-year-old that was, you know, could smoke at home, you know, and you know, he could smoke cigarettes or drink a beer or something. And his parents were like, whatever, you know. So, you know, we could go over there and just kind of watch movies. And we never watched movies once. It was like a marathon. Like we'd watch the movie and then we'd like shake up the popcorn on the stove and you know, get out the new Coke or whatever, and then go back and watch it again, man. You know, like we would watch movies and VHS tapes start degrading. So we were just watching this like half snowed out alien movie.
Yeah. You got to play around with the tracking button.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, just that clock is just blinking 12 for like 4 years, you know, it's just blinking.
Kids just don't know today how, you know, like the struggle. Yeah.
We didn't care. But, you know, I didn't even think about this until this moment. I think eventually we got it on Laserdisc.
Nice.
Hell yeah.
Right? And then watched it. So, yeah, I probably watched this movie 14, 15 times.
That's amazing.
You know, I mean, all the way through.
Because, I mean, you still were on the younger side and, you know, just very, very young when Alien came out. So when this sequel comes out, what was your familiarity with what this world was, what the original film was about?
You know, to be bluntly honest about it, I don't think I knew at the time that there was an original movie. That predated me. I mean, that was like 1979 or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I saw the original Alien movie until the 90s or something because, you know, I was... And that was doing, you know, once you get into the film industry and you start to like study directors and things, you start studying like everything a director did, whether it was popular or not. And so I started studying like Ridley Scott and I was like, wait a minute, what's this alien thing? And I look at him like, oh, you know, and then you're like, okay, there's a movie before this. So as a kid, I didn't know. I just quite frankly didn't know. And then when the director's cut came out years later, that was an exciting an additional experience because you're like, oh wow, yeah, this makes even more sense. So yeah, that's my experience.
The most successful Aliens prequel is Alien.
Yes.
Yeah.
We
because there are others.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll probably touch on those other more recent films. And I do understand, you know, it's a 80s podcast that we have here, but I do feel like it's difficult to kind of like talk about Aliens without at least addressing its predecessor.
World and lore that's mm-hmm. been created at this point. And even though I had seen it, because part of the reason why I saw it in the theater is because my dad was such a huge fan of the original, I don't think I don't know how well I like tracked or really was super familiar with the original when I saw the sequel. Like I knew that there was an alien mm-hmm. and I knew that there were more now. Mm-hmm. I knew that Sigourney Weaver survived. Mm-hmm. That's like most of it. I've seen all of the movies, even the Alien movies that no one likes, several times now. But Aliens, the sequel, not only is my favorite of this franchise, but I think possibly one of my favorite sequels ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know, I never thought about it like that, but it's definitely one of the best. And what I tell people is the original Alien and the original Terminator were horror films.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at their formula and you look at their format, I mean, even though they're fighting back against the bad creature or whatever, their weapons are so inferior that it's not a true like action film. But then when you look at Aliens and you look at Terminator 2, they're more action films than mm-hmm. anything else. Because now you're like going head to head with this alien. It's not so like overmatched and there's just so many, you know, guns and things going on. And so I think that James Cameron found his formula in that. And that people wanted big blockbuster action, you know, kind of before the whole Michael Bay stuff. Like he was Mr. Blockbuster, you know, yeah. blow everything up type of dude.
Which so makes me really excited yeah. for Titanic Part 2.
There you go.
I'm waiting for that sequel.
Who knows? That's going to be so interesting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're bringing up so many great points, and I'm curious, you know, so Aliens was 86, mm-hmm. and then Terminator mm-hmm. was 84. You're still young at this point, so was Terminator a film you had seen before Aliens, if you remember?
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
That was a very impressionable film on me as well. I really love the first Terminator. It was just so gritty to me. Like mm-hmm. the movies are very different. You can see in the budget. I think the first Terminator movie was like a $4 million film. Mm-hmm. And that was just really James Cameron and his experience and animation and special effects, just really putting it all to work in his own like home project, you know? And it had everything in it. It had, you know, the futuristic, it had the presence, it had the creature, it had the, you know, pulling your eye out thing. Like it had all kinds of, you know, stuff to it. And it just, that was an impressionable movie for me as well. I think I like Aliens better just because it was so much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just like, hey, let's give this dude some money and see what he can do. And, but still both movies were pretty impressionable on me. And then some things were like, why did you do this? Like The Abyss and, mm-hmm. you know, some of those movies are like, why did you even create this? Like, this is not what you do. And, you know, I like also the other big James Cameron at the time was the Rambo sequel, which mm-hmm. if you want to talk about conversations, the Rambo sequel was a pretty cool sequel to the first one. But the first one was really more of a drama type of thing where the second one was just like, let's just start shoot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that, Rambo First Blood Part 2 is possibly my least favorite sequel for what you just mentioned because of like the original First Blood was actually a really solid movie. I mean, it gets a little ridiculous at times, but it actually is trying to at the end address kind of a serious issue. But then you're right, like once it gets into the several sequels, it's just blow up as much stuff as possible.
Well, you bring up a great point because there is kind of a parallelism between the original, First Blood and Alien.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what Cameron chose to do with the second installments of each franchise. And, you know, in terms of, you know, how successful he was, you know, I know that's like really subjective according to like the moviegoer. But I found one thing that you said, Michael, really interesting because, you know, you really enjoyed kind of these earlier films of his mm-hmm. between Terminator and Aliens. And you're right. Like he definitely has kind of pivoted away from, I mean, Terminator 2 was probably the last kind of more action-ish, you know, kind of in line with that earlier work. Because
that's just
because
you haven't seen Avatar 2.
Well, yeah, I mean, none of us have. I mean, apparently we have Avatar 2 through 5 yeah. coming down the pipeline.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's not to say, I mean, I enjoyed Avatar. I thought it was an amazing experience. I mean, he's done a lot for cinema, just in general. Mm-hmm. But between what you were mentioning, Michael, about like enjoying his earlier work and then also being somebody who kind of like studies different directors, I mean, would you say that for you, that's what you consider kind of like prime Cameron, or have you kind of followed along with the rest of his films in his later career?
The only thing I didn't really like about Avatar was that I already knew the whole plot of the story, you mm-hmm. know, as soon as that dude, you know, rolled off into a wheelchair and started talking about transferring his body, it was over. Like, it, mm-hmm. you just kind of had to watch it. And so I thought that the beginning was really cool of Avatar. I like the setup of it, but you know, it just takes more than graphics. I'm more of a story guy. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. yeah, it was cool. I mean, you respect it. It takes a long time to do. They broke new ground as far as technology is concerned. That's kind of a whole different argument than, is this a great film? You know,
sure.
I was sitting in the film thinking to myself, I'll never watch this again, you know?
Right.
When I was in there.
Yeah.
So I'm a big story person. I tell people that even though the equipment has gotten better over the years, the writing has not. And that goes, you know, for film and music in many ways where, yeah, the gear is better, but you know, it's really, it gets down to story. And I think story wise, Terminator was fresh. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really impressive the way he kind of tied it all together and kind of let you know and everybody in the '80s was making these post-apocalyptic things, but to kind of tie in the post-apocalyptic theme to where somebody was actually coming back and trying to do something about it. Those type of stories are really cool. I'm not really big into time travel when people start jumping around too much, but I really thought that one story was his best work. And I think that probably the most passion in it. And the people in his movies were not that popular, you know, mm-hmm. Arnold and, you know, it's just the whole thing was it was really like one of the first indies, right? Like if you really mm-hmm. wanted that independent film vibe, you got that from the first Terminator vibe. You know, what you got later on, you know, is his, I guess, glory moment was probably Terminator 2, but it was just so big and so action packed and it had the kid in there and, you know, they're high fiving and all the slang from the late 80s mm-hmm. and, you know, the hip little kid and all that. And it was a very, very movie that appealed on a commercial level just to the planet more than the first gritty, dirty, you know, the alien is still crawling after you threw everything out here. Not the alien, but the cyborg is still mm-hmm. crawling after you kind of thing, even though you've thrown everything at it and you're completely injured and you're trying to survive. Like the first time you watch that movie, you're like, oh damn, what's going to happen? And the second one is kind of like, okay, we already know what's going to happen. So
the second one, you're like, yeah. Hey, I remember all of this from the Guns N' Roses video that came out before the movie.
But it's so interesting exactly. what you're saying, because now as you're kind of elaborating on this, it makes me think of kind of like a similar trajectory in George Lucas's career.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, Star Wars was also kind of made under, like, for lack of a better like way of putting it, grittier term. It's, you know, yes. like he didn't have everything available to him. Mm-hmm. And now that he does, you know, like same in that he has done a ton for kind of the evolution of cinema, whether it's good or bad, that could be argued another time, but he has impacted just the way we make movies in the same way yeah. that Cameron has. But then as far as like story goes, you know, yeah. there's a lot to be discussed, as you know, the first three Star Wars films would indicate.
Yeah. I mean, as far as story goes, I think so if we're kind of talking about Cameron's work in the Terminator movies versus the Alien movies. Mm-hmm. In the Terminator movies and Terminator 2, we learn a lot more about like what this Terminator is, like what Schwarzenegger's character is mm-hmm. is kind of about. In Aliens, it's basically, hey, remember this like crazy murder machine that no one could stop? What if there were hundreds of them?
Yeah.
We're not going to really tell you anything more about the aliens, but this is going to be amazing.
All right, so Michael, the one thing that we haven't even touched on yet, I mean, we've already covered a lot, but we haven't actually talked about the casting in Aliens, okay. which I'm so curious to know how you feel about it. I know I have my thoughts and Derek has his, but mm-hmm. I mean, we'll start at the top. So we'll start with Sigourney Weaver. How do you feel about her reprising her role as Ellen Ripley?
I thought it was great. I really couldn't see anyone else in that role for that particular movie. And James Cameron is known for writing these very strong female lead roles. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was one of the leaders of that in the 80s. And as a kid, honestly, I didn't really, you know the difference. I mean, she was like the hero. I wasn't looking at it like it was a huge, like, you know, civil rights breakthrough mm-hmm. or anything mm-hmm. where women were getting these strong roles in action films. I mean, obviously women had very, very powerful roles in a lot of dramas, but
right.
To see her do this in an action film was cool. Kind of follow the pattern a little bit of Terminator when you find out that the real true hero of the Terminator series is actually, you know, the female lead. Mm-hmm. And so I thought Sigourney Weaver was great in it. As far as her entire career is concerned, I mean, I don't know how much range that she really has, but mm-hmm, mm-hmm. at playing this character in this particular movie, I thought it was really strong casting. Obviously, you had, I forget the actor's name, but he was in
Michael
Terminator
Bean.
As well. What's that?
Michael Biehn.
Yes.
Corporal Hicks.
He was great. And I liked the diverse cast of Marines, and I like mm-hmm. the little military flavor to it all, right? In that whole Full Metal Jacket era, you know, it was like they were a bunch of old, you know, gamey Vietnam vets who were on a spaceship. So I kind of liked the casting of that, and I thought it was good. I thought it was right on point. I really couldn't imagine other actors mm-hmm. in those roles in that particular film.
Well, I mean, this is awesome because we're in complete agreement with you. I mean, that's one thing that I love about this movie. I mean, boy, you brought up so many good points. I think the first, before I forget, the one thing that I think is so neat, first of all, how cool that as a young boy, you're just seeing this protagonist and you're not thinking about them in terms mm-hmm. of being a guy or a girl or whatever. They're just the hero or heroine, whatever, of the movie. And I think that that is something that's like so important. And you're absolutely right. I honestly don't know how much credit Cameron gets, because you are spot on in saying that he definitely led the way in having really strong women save the day, you know?
Sure.
And that's through all of his movies.
Yes,
really.
The Abyss, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Abyss, Titanic.
Yes.
Even Alita, Battle Angel.
Which that was just a couple years ago. I didn't catch that one.
Yeah.
But I think that that's so neat and a part of his, you know, career that maybe isn't talked about as much. But so I'm really glad that you brought that up. And, sure. you know, we'll do like research, obviously, before we like get on the line about things. I did see something that like he was kind of misinformed about Weaver's, being signed on already for the mm-hmm. sequel. So he wrote it thinking, yeah, she's like 100% coming back.
Oops.
And that was not the case.
Oh,
and so, you know, there had to be some finagling, and that's kind of how she got a payday out of it, because she didn't really want to necessarily come back. You know, she felt like I think there was like nervousness there. Like the portrayal of Ripley in Alien was done in such a way, it's like you obviously don't want to diminish that character. Mm-hmm. So I could see why she'd be nervous. I'm curious. Again, we're talking about kind of all these films that came out in quick succession. Had you seen Ghostbusters previous to Aliens, if you remember?
That's a good question. Probably, okay. Because Ghostbusters was a theatrical release I could get into.
Okay, right? Yeah.
And so So I would say probably. I don't remember with clarity, but I love some Ghostbusters too.
Okay.
And the 80s was full of those, like mm-hmm. It was also what I call one-liner movies, you know, the one-liner comedies where mm-hmm. where you're just trying to get in a one-liner. I mean, anything with Bill Murray in it is just funny. Yes. And Ghostbusters. Yeah, don't get me started. That was a cool film.
I was just curious if like you had already had like a perception of Sigourney Weaver before seeing her in Aliens.
No.
I saw Ghostbusters first. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, honestly, no, and to tell you the truth, I I don't know. I wasn't really familiar with her work, you know, when I saw Aliens. And to tell you the truth, I probably didn't even put two and two together at the time that it was even the same person.
Okay.
You know, being a young kid. So, no, I really had no impression. You know, I thought it was perfect. I thought it was perfect casting for her. And I actually wanted to see a lot more of her in Chappie. I think that it would have been really, really cool because I enjoyed that movie a lot. And I was hoping for more Sigourney Weaver when I saw that. But is she, without me even consciously realizing it, yeah, she went down as top action hero right there with, you know, in my mind with, you know, Stallone and Schwarzenegger and all those people. She was right there. You know, it didn't, you know, I never really thought twice about it. She was just on top, you know,
just held her own. And same. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one point that you brought up that is, again, kind of, I don't know, maybe kind of like a Cameron trademark is, you know, a lot of these actors that have been in his films have obviously gone on to have huge blockbuster careers, you know, sure. Schwarzenegger and Weaver and all these people. But
by being in more of his movies.
By being in, yeah, somewhat by being in just more there of his movies. Go. But I think he has a really keen eye for finding talent because, mm-hmm. you know, it's sometimes hard when you're looking through the lens of like, you know, 2021 and you're trying to remember that these people like weren't, except for Weaver, because at this point, by the time she's in Aliens, she is a known figure. No, she
sure,
is, between Alien course. And Ghostbusters and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
but everybody right. else, not so much.
Well, mm-hmm. we got Michael Biehn
yeah,
from
but,
Terminator, but then the other guy who was also in Terminator, who was in Aliens.
Bill Paxton. Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, yeah. that is the thing that I'm so amazed by. And now to your point about Michael Biehn, yes, Terminator is 2 years preceding Aliens, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're already in production
yeah.
on Aliens. So, like, you know, it's not necessarily like he had already kind of like blown up. And actually, I don't know, Michael, were you aware that Michael Biehn was actually like he was recasted, somebody else was going to play that role
for Aliens or for Terminator?
For Aliens.
I didn't know that. No, I didn't know that history, and I always liked him as an actor. And I think with a lot of directors, you'll see they have a go-to cast that's
yes.
just people who are easy to work with. And look, I can tell you from someone who's worked on major film sets, they can be a grind, and mm-hmm. the people you're grinding with really makes a difference. And certain mm-hmm. people, you just want to be like, I don't want any lip. I don't want any back talk. I just want to make a good movie. And I need a couple people on the set who that when I tell them to do something, they just freaking trust me and do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where Michael Biehn, I mean, I don't know this. I've never talked to the guy, but I think that's kind of where the James Cameron, Michael Biehn thing was. It's like, you know what, this is what I'm going to have you do. And it's like, sir, yes, sir. You know, it's like you want to have some people on set who are just you can just work with and you know what you're going to get out of them and they're talented and, you know, they're not going to be questioning you a million times while you're trying to meet schedules and make shots and put up with the stress of a huge film. And you'll see that, of course, with Scorsese, and you'll see that mm-hmm. with some people where you're like, man, the same actors are over and mm-hmm. over. Even Christopher Nolan. You know, I mean, good gracious, dude. Like, sometimes I have to look at a Christopher Nolan film twice to figure out which film it is because it's the same dudes on set every single time.
Same cast. Yeah.
So,
no, you bring up so many good points, and I think you're totally right about Michael Biehn. So, I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with the actor James Remar. He was originally cast, like, the role that I know him most from is he was in Sex and the City for a time as Samantha's boyfriend.
Okay.
He has had like a long career.
Is that the Mr. Big guy?
No, it's not Mr. Big.
Okay.
He's like kind of this like rich dude that Samantha like anyway.
Welcome to Aliens.
Yeah. So I know him yeah. from other stuff. But in any case, he was cast as Corporal Hicks and
oh, wow.
I try not to bring up the personal stuff, but I mean, he's been pretty candid about it that he was dealing with the drug issue and
yeah.
was caught with them and he was dismissed from the film. And so they had already started principal photography and mm-hmm. actually the scene where the Marines go into the nest for the first time,
uh-huh.
you know, among those characters is Corporal Hicks, but you only see him from behind in certain shots. That's actually the other actor.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, they couldn't reshoot that because it was just with the set issue. Anyway.
This is like the opposite of the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. So they brought him in, you know, a couple days into shooting. And I think you're right. I think, you know, Cameron's like, okay, I need somebody that I know is reliable and can do the job. And I guess thankfully Bean was available and came in, and he's great. He's so great.
Yeah, that's a major character in this movie. I mean, that's a big role.
Yeah. I mean, isn't he third billed? So he I thought just did a bang up job. And yes, just in general, I thought the casting was really well done. I mean, part of it is the camaraderie that
the chemistry between all of them is just
off the charts.
Yeah. It sells it.
And apparently, again, from what I read, I know movies are, you know, they're not typically shot in order. But one thing that Cameron did to try to kind of just like play up that aspect of them having this like great familiarity with each other is that those beginning scenes where they wake up and they're getting dressed and they're in the locker room and they're eating together, those were filmed last. So that at that point, the cast had been working together for several months. And so they felt like there was that camaraderie there.
Yeah, I still enjoy that scene for Vasquez's decision to, after what I can only guess was a long hypersleep, immediately go into pull-ups.
Yeah, Michael, is that something that, I mean, that's not normal for either one of us.
You're going to strain something.
We do not wake up after a hypersleep and be like, okay, so I'm going to do some chin-ups, I'm going to do some pull-ups.
You have got to warm up. It's important.
So we kind of got through, you know, our thoughts on Ripley and the Marines. So second billing in this movie is Carrie Henn, who plays Newt. And I'm just curious, Michael, again, you know, having seen it as a kid yourself, do you remember at all your thoughts about like a child being in a movie like this? Did you feel any kind of connection to her? Did you like that she was in the movie?
No, I thought that was cool, and I thought it added a greater sense of tension. It added more of a just a we really have to survive this for more than ourselves element. I thought that was good writing, you know, to do that.
And so, you had mentioned at the top of our conversation, also having seen, you know, later on, like I guess what maybe you would call the director's cut, or just like, you know, scenes put back in that had been deleted for time. Mm-hmm. And did you feel like maybe this is something you would more recognize as an adult viewer, but because there was supposed to be more of this backstory of Ripley losing her daughter because she was out there for 57 years before they found her again, did it still have like an emotional resonance for you, even if like on the first viewing, all of that was gone?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this... I mean, that's a big yes, because I thought, I think story plays a part, and I think that just the whole story rolling up, you know, just how evil that corporation was, just how sick they were to even take people into this, their disregard for human life, and, you know, looking for the you know, capitalistic value of these very dangerous things. I mean, I think that it just really laid out the whole beginning just so much better with the director's cut. You know, in some cases, the director's cut is really good, and adding the footage that you missed is really good. In the case of Justice League, I really don't see the difference. I thought it was still a bad movie.
Shots fired. You
know, oh man, it took me four like different nights to get through that. That was awful.
Glad you brought up Wayland, because the company, because yes, that plays definitely well. Okay, so in Alien, they pretty much just always refer to it as the company. You see the name of the company, like I think on their jackets or a hat or that sort of thing, but it's always just referred to as the company. And so we do get a little bit more insight into what this company is all about. And, you know, when Ripley is, for instance, trying to kind of defend herself and her actions from Alien, really their bottom line is like, you destroyed a $42 million ship.
They don't care a bit about any of the cast.
Yeah.
The crew of the ship who were, you know, killed by the alien, but they probably don't think that. They think that she just atomized them. And they're like, but the ship.
Yeah. That was, that's the thing that Derek and I, so we always, you know, rewatch the movie ahead of talking to our special guest. And that was one thing that kind of occurred to me last night we were watching. I was like, you know, if they don't believe Ripley and the fact that she had alien, and that's why she blew up the ship, then she's just a straight up murderer, like a serial killer. And the fact that they just like have this meeting and they're like, yeah, we don't believe you. You blew up our ship. Okay, so bye. And they do nothing to like address the fact that they all have to, by default, think that she deliberately murdered her crew.
It's wild. And that, you know, that goes into the great writing in that you want your hero to be partially misunderstood because it makes you pull and root for that hero even more. And that goes to like, you know, people aren't sure if Wolverine is a good guy. They're not sure if the Punisher is a good guy. They're not sure if the Batman is good for Gotham. They're not sure, you know, and having that question and them always having to kind of redeem themselves, is just good writing. It's a strong, you know, concept that people put into their hero concepts. And I think to see how sick this corporation was. And so the filmmaker, you know, the director is like teaching you that this person is this good person that has morals and is trying to do the right thing. He's just trying to survive. And then you have this other point of view where everything that the hero has done is can be completely misconstrued and looked at in a completely different way. And I think that's part of the celebration. And then also part of the excitement when the corporate guys get killed too, right? Because it's like, you idiots, you deserved it, you know? So I just think that's good writing.
No, I totally agree. And so I'm curious, when you saw this the first time, were you catching on that Burke was ultimately going to become his own villain? Or were you surprised by that reveal?
I was surprised because it just, at the end of the day, you're like, man, you know, it's either, you know, Sigourney Weaver's got to overcome, she has to work just as hard to overcome her allies as she does her enemies, you know?
I mean, that was a really hardcore move. Like, I'm going to trap you,
yeah,
get these face huggers out, disable the camera. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
And also, I'm going to kill this child who's been through insane trauma.
I mean, Ripley and Newt must have been so sleep deprived because he had to have been making some sound in there when he was doing all that. I mean, neither here nor there, but just saying. I think that Paul Reiser, as the actor portraying him, did an awesome job.
He did too good of a job because now no matter what I ever see him in, I'm like, fucking Burke.
Everything. Yeah. He's typed. He's done. Right. That's all you can think of.
I mean, that's why I never got into Mad About You. I mean, that's kind of a little bit of a throwback as well. But like, I was like, no.
Don't buy his crap, Helen Hunt.
But he also, that's again, just kind of coming back to this common theme of great casting. And again, if we're thinking 1986, sure, most of these actors had done some work already at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Weaver was probably, again, the only one that was really a bona fide major star. I'm sure Bean is soon to rise to that level as Terminator becomes more popular. But, you know, just like, because everybody, and you know what? The one thing that I don't want to gloss over, because I know Derek just briefly mentioned him, is Bill Paxton. How do you feel about his performance in this film?
I can't find a single human on earth that does not like Bill Paxton. He's just, you know, very sad to see, you know, him go. But that's, you know, that's the classic line of the film. You know, that's the one where me and it doesn't matter how many times I watch the film, I erupt in laughter. You know, you know, it was great because he's the only person that realized, like, we're doomed.
That's actually a really good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Pretty much saw the writing on the wall.
He's like, yeah, we're like in the middle of checkmate right now. Great casting, you know, the perfect person to deliver those lines. And I couldn't think of anyone else doing it, you know, that way. And I thought it was great. And nobody likes to see him go. They're like, oh, you know. So, yeah, all around. I mean, for an action film to have that many memorable moments, you can't really remember Aliens without remembering, you know, him too. So
the character in the film too, like, I was so rooting for him, you know, like, I think that was the loss that I took the hardest.
Yeah.
For sure. Were
you going to say something to
him? No, I mean, he kind of has this a little bit of a redemption arc within the movie where he has such an immediate, like, yeah, we're doomed response, because, you know, you talked about it before, how there was such a buildup, like, look at the equipment that these guys have, look mm-hmm. at how badass they mm-hmm. are, and then they just get annihilated mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. the nest. And so it obviously had such a strong effect on Paxton's character. And it's Ripley, I think, who's like, I'm sick of your shit and we yeah. need you.
Yeah.
And he kind of turns it around. Yeah. And even when he's getting dragged down by multiple aliens with one of them, like, covering his face, he's like blasting him away. Like, oh, you want some of this? Like, how about you?
Literally yeah. goes out guns blazing. Like, yeah.
So, yeah.
He was amazing. And actually, another thing, just a very random sidebar, you know, when we were talking about how some people who actually, you know, were part of the Marines took a little bit of issue with the depiction, I guess another point of contention was that, you know, he talks about how he was just days away from getting out. And yeah. apparently, if that were yeah. really the case, if somebody was just days away from getting out, they would have never put him in a situation where there would be that much danger and the possibility of getting killed. So I just thought that was interesting, that was yeah. something people had an issue with. I'm like, but it makes sense.
That's yeah. such a common yeah. thing in these movies. Like, every cop yeah. movie is like, I was 2 days from retirement.
Yeah, all the time. You know? Yeah. All yeah. the time. Yeah.
But that was one. I think that just goes further with the with the evil corporation. It's like, mm-hmm. nah, this is going to be a day at the park. It's going to be a simple, you know, go in and get a sample and come out kind of thing. And you can handle it. You know, you got all this gear, all the best gear money can buy, you know. No prob, you know, and that theme, you see that in like Predator, you see almost that exact same theme. And,
yeah.
I think that makes it, you know, I think that makes it, you got to humanize some characters. You always got to have that character that you didn't really want to die, yeah. That does. And yeah, I think, you know, just a lot of those, the aliens just really hit like a lot of those general writing points that people like to see, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a wonderful point, and probably one of the reasons why, you know, now we're 35 years on from this film coming out and why it stands up. I mean, I don't really put a ton of stock in like lists of like best movies and that sort of thing, but it's, you know, like it is among, you know, top 100 on various lists. And I think that, you know, one thing that has been brought up time and again over this conversation, which really points to why, is like, this could have been just a really kind of mindless action horror kind of crossover flick, but it does have great writing,
mm-hmm.
which mm-hmm. makes it a great story. And that's why it can hold up after 35 years. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But
that's what people remember, is the
exactly,
writing.
Exactly. That's what people remember. Well, Michael, this has been just such a pleasure to have you on the show. It's been really cool because also in talking about Aliens, we've gotten to hear about kind of like the way that all these different franchises like work, the way that like knowledge of them from the fans and love for them for the fans impact how, you know, these films are perceived. Mm-hmm. So it's just been really cool to talk to you, and we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of our conversation, I mm-hmm. mentioned Film Festival Circuit.
Sure.
And I just wanted to, you know, ask if you'd like to share with our listeners, you know, just a little bit more information about what those different festivals are, and if somebody is out there with a movie where they might be able to go to submit.
All right, well, thank you for this opportunity. It was a good conversation. I hope we get to. I hope you guys will invite me back for the Running Man episode.
Oh, right here, yeah.
But
you got it.
Yeah. But you know, I'm a person who's loved film long before I was in the film industry. Well, I made a little comedy film long ago, and you know, it was kind of a lot of bad language. It was vulgar. It was called John the Angry Mover. And it was about these like these movers and just all the stuff they go through where like they, you know, they're like breaking furniture and flirting with the, you know, the guys working or flirting with like the, you know, the lady who they're moving and all this kind of stuff. It was just a really stupid thing, but it was just, there to make you laugh with all these outrageous little things in it. And when I put that film on the film festival circuit, I started submitting. I made a lot of mistakes, and my film was way too long, and I was getting rejected to a lot of film festivals, and not sending out a very good package. Like, it was just like, take the DVD and take out the permanent black magic marker and like scribble the name of your film and the tracking number on it, drop it in an envelope and fire it off to Sundance and sit back and wait for the lottery to happen. Right. Like, I was just going to win. And the next thing you know, I'd be directing Aliens 4 or whatever. But, you know, it kind of came to reality with submitting films to film festivals that this was a much more competitive and, let's just say, a lot of it just really depends on your packaging and how things are presented, and not all film festivals are created equal. Mm-hmm. And after I cut my film down to, you know, from like a 26 minute comedy down to like a 14 minute comedy, I started getting accepted everywhere. And so I started traveling and going to these film festivals, and it varied so much. It was kind of disappointing where I would get played. I tell people the story. My film would play like in the middle of this block of like dramas and documentaries. And then my stupid film would come on and people would look at me like, why did you create this? And I'll never forget. There was a film one time. This was, I went to this film festival and it was held at Harvard University, and we were like in this classroom. So like all these chairs and desks were like pushed up to the side of the wall. And like, there was this cheap projector, and like this guy with his, you know, Mac laptop, like puts my DVD in, and he's like turning up the audio, like wah, 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 on his, like, you know, like pressing the button on his laptop to turn up the audio, and there's like this little trashy speaker, and I'm thinking to myself, this is not a good experience to be, you know, having a film. And the film preceding mine, this was in 2007, so this film preceding mine was about a documentary about some kid who his lungs were exposed to like the dirt at the World Trade Center and stuff. And then he couldn't get health care in the United States because of all this discrimination against illegal aliens or something. So he had to go to Cuba, and the Cuban doctors couldn't save him. And then the film ends with the kid flatlining and dying, and like the flatline, like going across the screen, going doo, like while the credits were rolling. Oh. I mean, it was like the most tear jerking, like, what in the world? And then my film comes on, you know, and like people are looking at me like, dude, what is wrong with you? And I'll never forget standing up in this Q&A and like nobody asked me a question. They were just like, I'm surprised they didn't like all walk out. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm going to make a comedy film festival. I'm going to make a comedy film festival, and I'm going to play my movie in the damn festival. And I'm not going to give myself an award. I'm not that much of an idiot. But I said, you know, let me at least just like slip it in, you know, and I was hoping that we would get 20 or 30, you know, comedy films or whatever, and we could play them on a weekend. Well, long story short, I opened up the Houston Comedy Film Festival, living at Houston at the time. 2008 was my first festival in Houston. All the way until 2015, that's all I did was Houston. And we moved to Austin so I could work in post-production. You know, now that my wife and I are having babies and stuff, and I can't be on set, and, and you know, she's flying around as a flight attendant, so that wasn't going to work. So one of us had to figure out a stay-at-home job, so I started working in post. I opened up the Austin Comedy Short Film Festival, and the whole idea was, let me just close Houston down. Let me just close this thing down so I don't have to drive 175 miles to Houston. Or 150 miles, whatever it is, to Houston to go do this festival all the time. I just want to do it in my own backyard. Nobody cares, right? And so I go to close the Houston Comedy Film Festival because I'd had this Austin Comedy Short Film Festival open. And I got a notification that we were ranked in the top 100 in the world for Houston.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, well, I guess I can't close that. That's not going to work. So I start doing both. You know, my wife is originally from Oregon, and we moved to
Okay, so that's the connection.
Yeah, we wanted to raise it. You know, we knew we were having a second one. We wanted to raise our kids. And so we moved up here, and I opened up the Portland Comedy Film Festival, and it was over, man. You know, people were emailing me from 2-3 years before going, hey, Michael, I can't believe you have another festival. Like, I got to send my stuff to you.
So, I have to say, though, like, in terms of everything that you encountered with the reception that sometimes comedy films, feature or short, are received with, you know, I so appreciate that there are, you know, you're leading the way, but that there is a community of people who can appreciate what comedy is, and that you know, that is not to be disrespectful towards, you know, more serious genre film, but to get somebody to laugh, to get mm-hmm. somebody to smile, to forget about whatever is going on in their world for a little bit, that's important. And the fact that you have, you know, started these film festivals that in large part cater to that really important part of just being in the world and finding a release is awesome. I just think that that's amazing. And I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to kind of make a point of saying that, like, I appreciate so much that you kind of, you know, took action on that instinct to do that and to start these film festivals.
We have 10 film festivals. We have now I have 4 in Texas, 2 in Nevada, and 4 in Oregon. And we have plans to expand to even more states. And the whole thing is that I want to give people a bit of entertainment, but I also want to show them something different. You know, I think film festivals are known for the politics, and we've made our niche in that we're not here for the politics. We're just here to show the best stuff. And none of our judges are in the festival. None of our judges are in there trying to like bring somebody else down. And we just want to show the best stuff of each category. And I think there's a certain, you know, I don't want to say purity, like we're holier than thou or anything, but I really feel like we're our judges are just giving the best opinion of what they really think is the best films that they're going to put out there. And spreading it around to different geographies really does get different results. There's an assumption that, oh, the Houston Comedy Film Festival and the Austin Comedy Film Festival are the same thing. And that's actually furthest from the truth. And there's any two festivals that are the most polar opposite groups of judges in our entire network. It's Houston and Austin. They choose completely different stuff. They have totally different tastes. Most of my Houston judges speak Spanish as a second language, and they have a greater appreciation of some international films and subtitled things. And they definitely like films. They're really into pacing. They're seasoned filmmakers. They don't like anything to be slow. They like the laughs to come and hit hard. And then the Austin group is like my weed smoking, like, come on, dude, like, let's hang out. Let's just watch this movie, dude, you know, kind of thing. And if anything, my Austin judges are a lot more like my Portland judges, to be honest.
Well, if I may, so, I just wanted to, you know, interject to say that in terms of like community, I mean, I am very fortunate because I have had the experience of, you know, being part of that community. I mean, last year, Derek and I were able to attend Portland Comedy. And I just wanted to say a couple of things. First of all, in terms of community, so we were, you know, obviously still kind of in the middle of this whole pandemic thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it had you made a really safe and smart pivot by making it a drive-in experience. And even though we were all in our own cars, you know, after every film, to hear the car horns honking as like a means of clapping for the film was just really heartwarming. And again, even though, you know, everybody's keeping their distance, everybody's doing the things that they're supposed to do, I really felt this like camaraderie among the filmmakers. And just kind of going off that, you know, the fact that, you know, now, yes, we're kind of 16 months in, though we are light, you know, is at the end of the tunnel. We're fully vaxxed. Everything's, you know, getting hopefully back to a good place. But you had to deal with really challenging circumstances throughout 2020 and early 2021. And the way that you managed that was really so impressive. And you know, just in addition to saying, okay, how can we still make this happen and pivoting to a drive-in experience to keep everybody safe, but then also the way that I saw firsthand you being so generous and gracious in spirit in terms of like wanting to help other businesses that were also, you know, really going through hard times. You know, I know you screened Portland at Sunshine Mill, and the way that you worked with them to help them, you know, have some business during a time where they weren't going to otherwise. Sure. I just wanted a chance to say that I just respect so much the way that you handled all that And we're certainly not just thinking of the festival, but about other businesses that also could use support during that time. So, you know, between the community that you have grown with all these different festivals and just, you know, I don't know how you kept your head on your shoulders throughout all this. Like, it really is, it's really impressive to me.
Because it wasn't just a, you know, the pivot worked so well that if you didn't know better, you would just think, well,
that's the way it is.
Yeah, this is how it always is. And it was,
thanks.
You know, Anna mentioned it was, you know, back in the middle of the pandemic. And actually, it was right before things started ramping up again and started getting a little bit more concerning again.
Especially for us in LA. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that experience, you know, I'll always remember as one of the coolest, most memorable things that we were able to do. And it was run so well. And it was so amazing to get a chance to see the film on a big screen with everybody honking their horns. It was just a great experience. And so I'm happy that I have the chance to thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. And I appreciate that you could see, you know, what an undertaking that was. And honestly, you know, I think that the drive-in theater experience for a film festival is a better experience than the theater. Just flat out, it just is. Number one, you're on a bigger screen. Number two, you're outdoors.
Yep.
And number three, it's way more social than sitting in a than sitting just in the theater, in my opinion. Now, that being said, I love Alamo Drafthouse. I love the venues that we use. You know, great sound systems, and they're really cool. But the drive-in theater experience to me is more unique and is the biggest surprise of my career. I didn't really realize until I saw the films up there and the reaction from people watching those films that it would be that cool. And it really is that cool. The problem with the drive-in theaters is now that it's not a craze anymore, some of them are starting to close.
Yeah.
And in Houston, we don't have an option. We went back to Alamo Drafthouse. We literally just did not have an option for a drive-in theater. In Austin, we're dealing with Doc's Drive-In Theater, which we love very, very much. And we kind of did a hybrid model with them. We did our screenplay readings at a theater, and we did our screenings at the drive-in theater. And the drive-in theater is building a little indoor place where we can start to have networking and awards and stuff like that there as well. But it's like working with the drive-in theaters. Sunshine Mill, we love. We're going to do Portland Comedy Film Festival in 2 weeks at Sunshine Mill again.
So cool.
Super exciting, but we don't have a venue in Portland that will accommodate a group our size. They still have COVID restrictions up in Oregon, and we don't have a venue that can hold more than 50 people, and we typically have way more than that. So we're still at Sunshine Mill. We love Sunshine Mill. The only complaint about Sunshine Mill is they're not in Portland, so if you're calling your thing the Portland Comedy Film Festival, that is weird for some people.
Well, that is technically true. The drive to get there is breathtaking.
Stunning.
Isn't it? Like, it's great.
I mean, like, people don't know it, but they're going to appreciate it once they realize that, like, that's what they get to experience on the way out there.
It's an easy drive, but it is
so
just
easy.
A gorgeous drive.
It is beyond I mean, honestly, we still talk about it, how magnificent it was, the natural scenery. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, the Columbia River Gorge is just one of those breathtaking places. I agree with you. I've actually fished out there on that river, and it's like you're in a postcard. Like, I've been fishing for salmon out there, and I'm watching bald eagles like teach their, you know, younger eagles to fish, you know, in the same river. It's truly amazing.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it sounds like then you're kind of going to do maybe a little bit of a hybrid model.
It really depends on the market. You know, Doc's Drive-In Theater in Austin, as long as we have a relationship with them and their business is going fine, we're going to try to make it work on their property. But at the same time, you know, we love Alamo Drafthouse. We started with Alamo Drafthouse in Houston. I really couldn't see us going anywhere else. And then in Oregon, we eventually want to get back to Portland. I think that our horror film event and our Portland comedy event, you know, I think those do really, really well in Oregon. And I think that the Oregon Short Film Festival, that's definitely its home, is Sunshine Mill now, because it's just so wide open. We're going to try to stick with Sunshine Mill for as many things as we can. With the horror films, we did notice that in the city of Portland, the freaks kind of come out at night. It was like its own little community of horror filmmakers. But for the year 2021, we're going to stick with Sunshine Mill as long as they'll stick with us. The great thing about them is that they're still open. But the bad thing is they're open for weddings and graduations and events. Yeah. And now they're like staffed to the point right. where they're exhausted.
Exactly. Right now.
They are absolutely – and they're having difficulties hiring people because a lot of people are – Yeah, people are still staying at home and getting supplemental unemployment and all that stuff. But you did ask me the question where to submit. So if you go to filmfestivalcircuit.com, which is my company, there's a little button at the top that says save 20%. We have a 20% promo code to all of our submissions. All of our festivals, all 10 of them, are listed on Film Freeway. And, you know, I encourage you to use promo codes. I think whether it's our festival or any other festival in the world, you should always email the festival first and ask them, hey, do you have any discounts available? Sometimes it's not always successful if you're just asking for full 100% fee waivers all the time. Mm-hmm. But if you're asking for discounts, that's showing that, hey, you're interested in the festival, but you're trying to stretch your submission dollar and you want to support the festivals that you submit to, but it gets expensive, right?
Yeah.
And use the discounts. That's what they're there for. And we encourage people to submit to multiple festivals that we offer. They're different groups. They're different experiences. I can tell you right now, the Reno Comedy Film Festival is a completely different experience from the Portland Comedy Film Festival. And if you really want to see how your film is going to be doing on the film festival circuit, you need to get it out there. Whether it's our festival or someone else's festival, you need to try different states. You need to get it out into different places and get it in front of different people. And don't give up on your film if you get rejected to two or three festivals in a row. Don't give up. And we also understand that there's a certain mentality where there are certain film festivals that I'm not going to name that are very aggressive nonprofit organizations that have geographic restrictions. So when we put out our film festival lineup for like Austin Comedy Film Festival, we'll get emails from other film festivals that I won't name that will actually say, if you screen at this festival, then you're not going to be qualified for our festival because we have geographic restrictions. So that's fine because for us, we have no problem deferring your submission to another season. We have no problem if your film is already online, if your film is a part of a series. We don't chase your film down and research you to see where you're screening. We just want to show the best stuff to our audience. And when it's the right time for you to submit, if you wanted to do the Academy Award, you know, festival qualifying festivals first and then come to us second, that's okay. We are not offended. We just really want to show the best material. Even if you already have distribution, no problem. We'll show your material as long as it's in high definition video. At least we don't want any old standard def 4:3 films, but we're a pretty open film festival. We have a sense of community. We open up a virtual networking session that I've committed to every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You never have to use a credit card. You never have to charge. We never charge. It's open to anyone, and it's a place where you can come in and just talk about the films and the projects that you're working on. And if you want to, you know, give a shout out to one of your trailers, or you want, you're looking for a friend or, you know, another fresh set of eyes to read your script, or if you just want to promote your Kickstarter campaign or your Indiegogo campaign and you're raising money, if you're looking for an investor, you're looking for a colorist, you're looking for a composer, it's a nice little group to be a part of. So check us out. If you go to filmfestivalcircuit.com, at the top there's a little networking button. You can click on that and you can just join us on Zoom any Wednesday, and I committed to doing those for the entire year, so that'll go all the way through the end of 2021. So that's please join us on that.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. Michael, thank you so much again. And everybody out there, you know, whether you are a filmmaker or just a film lover, please do check out filmfestivalcircuit.com. I mean, you will enter into a world of just so many amazing film festivals, hopefully some local to you, where you can experience these films. And like Michael was saying, just – you know, see different types of stories. So, Michael, we are just beyond thrilled. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I think that especially, you know, the conversation we had about, you know, how and why you started these film festivals really speak to kind of the indie film community, the comedy film community, and is a conversation that probably isn't had a lot. So thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate you. I appreciate your kind words. I appreciate this opportunity to come on and talk about a classic film that's near and dear to my heart. And I have, you know, great respect for you as filmmakers. And I also want to put out there, you know, if you are looking for a place to submit, I couldn't believe how many people walked up to me at the Austin Comedy Film Festival and said, this is the first film festival that I've ever been to. And I just want people to know that our film festival is about acceptance. It's not about rejection. Mm-hmm. We are wide open as far as the variety of films that we have. We do have standards. I mean, you are competing against others that are submitting, and it's typically the top 25 and 30% in that range that get in the festival. Not everybody gets in, but it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is, what color you are, how old you are, how young you are, if you're a student, if you're a hobbyist, if you were only able to shoot on an iPhone, or you don't have a lot of money in your production. We consider all films independently for their merit, and we truly want to entertain our audience. And so when you bring a film or a screenplay to us, I just want everyone out there to know that we're watching it, and we're watching it from the beginning to the end, and we're watching it with multiple people who really are looking for good things to submit and to screen in front of our audience. And we're giving you a shot in the best way that we know how and the most honest way that we know how. So at some point in your career, if you're thinking about submitting, please put us on the list somewhere. And whether it's comedy or any genre, we have multiple film festivals. We're looking for you. And it's about independent films. We're not name dropping. We don't have big feature stars and actors that come in and suck up all the attention. We don't put Ready Player One as a selection to our film festival. That makes no sense. That being said,
if someone does want to submit Running Man Part 2.
There you go. Well, that was Hunger Games, so it'd have to be Running Man Part 3. I know this is totally off topic, and I know we're going forever, but I read the Hunger Games prequel that she came out with. Uh-huh. Sandra Collins. I'm sorry what her name is now. I have to go back and look at the author, but that thing is awesome. So if they are going to continue with the whole Hunger Games thing, they do something where it goes like 80 years in the past or 70 years in the past. It is really, really good, that Hunger Games prequel. So I'll put that out there. You're definitely having me on for the Running Man episode. Right? You're booking me in for that. And again, thank you so much. This experience has been great. I just really can't thank you enough. I love talking to you both, and I hope that I get to see you again at a future event.
Yes, same here. Thank you, Michael. So that was really amazing. I mean, we're really lucky because not only did we get to talk about this awesome film with Michael, but we got to get like this really cool insight into what it was for him to get this film festival circuit going.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to talk through not just the movie, but everything else.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, this question is just silly but I gotta ask it. Derek, would you watch Aliens again?
Yeah. Yeah. I love this movie. I'll watch it just because, for no reason. Sometimes I fall asleep to Aliens, which sounds kind of crazy, but I do it.
It might literally be the thing that we throw on tonight when we go to bed, because it happens.
It makes it a challenge when we're rewatching it for purposes of this podcast, I hit like certain spots in the movie where I'm like, I'm usually knocked out
right
by this time. I forgot about this. This is awesome.
It is. I mean, so yeah. I mean, I said it very clearly at the top of our conversation that this is just one of our favorite films. We love this movie. So, of course. And samesies. You can throw it on anytime you want, and I'll be happy to have it on. So, listener call to action. I mean, okay, here's the thing. Because we do, you know, to varying degrees, kind of bring up the other films. Both the ones that are, you know, more directly connected to Alien and Aliens, because they contain, or it's a weird way to put it, but they have Sigourney Weaver in them. Yeah. So, you know, between 3 and Resurrection. And then we have these other newer films, these prequels. And I don't know. I mean, you and I have our opinions of those newer films, and I'm just personally curious how people feel they fit into the franchise as a whole. Do they feel like they've added to the franchise? Would we have just been better off with, you know, Alien 1 through 4? That's kind of where I stand with my call. I just want to know what people think.
And I've said multiple times now that it's not only like one of my favorite movies, but what I think is one of the best sequels ever. So my call is to name a better sequel. I want to know if you got a better sequel than Aliens, lay it on me. Let me know what it is.
Throwing it down, Danky.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. That's a good one. That's a really good one.
Someone's going to say Lethal Weapon 2. I know it.
So if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. It's the same handle for all three, and that is at 80s Montage Pod, and 80s is 80s. Okay, 2 weeks from now.
What's coming up?
Sneak peek.
What's it going to be?
It's going to be a fun one.
Is it?
Yeah. We're going back to I've talked about how much I love Rob Reiner and how much I think he is like kind of an underrated director of the 80s. So we're going back to another one of his beloved films, When Harry Met Sally.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'll have what he's having, what she's having.
What she's having.
What did he have? Did he have anything?
Wait, you don't know what that is referencing?
No, I know it.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I know it was,
yeah. It's like, I feel like everybody probably knows that.
I'm aware.
But yes, that is what we're going to be covering next. And so thank you so much for hanging with us today. And we will talk to you in 2 weeks' time.